Welcome to another edition of the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And this is indeed Milt Rosenberg back at the old stand, that is at WGN Radio in Chicago, using the old studio. And one of the reasons for doing that is that we've gathered together two members of the A-team. For the many years we did the radio program at WGN, there were four guys who really were regular fallback people for us as we discussed national affairs, international affairs, politics, troubles generally. They were Chris Roebling, Charles Lipson, Richard Ciccone, and Joe Mars. The first two, Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson, are with me again. And we've got a new recruit, Kitty Carth. I'm going to ask, I'll ask Roebling to introduce himself and the other two guests.
Thank you, Milt. <Uh-oh. laughs> Well, my name's Chris Roebling, and it's nice to be with you for this podcast recording session. Excuse me, and I have got a career that spans issues like broadcasting, government, politics, and a lot of corporate public affairs. Kitty Carth is a wonderful activist based in Chicago with many liberal causes and also a lot of international activity in
we
many...
We like to say in Chicago know-how with an international reach.
There you go.
When you identify Kitty as a liberal, do I understand that you welcome that because you are equally liberal yourself?
I'm liberal in my tastes.
But not in your politics.
Not in my politics.
And then we have the redoubtable Charles Lipson. That doesn't mean we doubt him. That means he's untouchable in his magnificence. What do you say about him?
Charles Lipson, former chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, director of graduate studies for many PhD candidates, a longtime raconteur on the Chicago political scene.
And I now start you with a challenge, one of those challenges I used to hit you guys with regularly. Well, all three of you, as you will see, imagine it is the year 2099, going towards the year 2100 and the beginning of a new century. You are writing a chapter for the book that you've been working on, which is sort of an historical work about the United States through the whole century now coming to an end. As you start the fourth chapter, it reads, 13 years into the new millennium, in other words, 2013, 13 years into the new millennium, what had to be said about the nation and the state of the American polity was, Chris, take it away.
After a pendulum swing in the direction of government power under the guise of national security after the events of 9/11, the United States was confronting another pendulum swing in the direction of government power to order society and the economy under the guise of President Obama's political agenda for his presidency.
And what did that augur? A little bit more of your introductory chapter on that particular year, 2013. What did that augur for the future as we saw the future unroll during the rest of the century?
I think people were beginning to see that just as they had rejected what they considered to be George Bush's excesses of government power in response to terrorism, they were beginning to reject President Obama's excesses of government power with respect to the domestic agenda.
Now we'll get Kitty's version of that same chapter.
You know, this is a fascinating question. And just yesterday I was talking with my interns about my great uncle who was born in about 1884 and lived till 1984. And came to Chicago as a young sailor when he was 14. On a sailing ship from Germany. I actually don't know if he was a legal immigrant or an illegal immigrant. He might have just jumped ship. I don't know. But he was here during the Columbian Exposition when many of my other relatives came over. My great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother actually courted at the Columbian Exposition. And I was talking to my interns about the Chicago and the America that those relatives of mine saw and watched from, you know, pre-industrial revolution really until, you know, in 1984, I was showing my uncle my computer and my laptop, or not my laptop, I guess, just my regular computer. But I thought about the changes that they've seen that they saw in their 100 years and what kind of changes I would see going from 1959 to 2059 or 2099. And I don't think the basic changes of society are going to be as great as they were in that 100 years. I think the platform that we have now, I don't think our economic systems are going to change as much as they did from, you know, monarchy to democracy. Hopefully we'll continue to grow the emerging democracies, and the democracies that have constitutions that are 20 years old and 50 years old will grow to be really true democracies.
Well, there we have two visions of the present and the near future, and we'll seek a third right now from Charles Lipson. I'll give you the stub again as we start this chapter. Again, the words were, 13 years into the new millennium, what had to be said about the American nation was?
The overriding question in 2014 was whether America's overextension and seeming decline were permanent or were instead temporary and reversible. That's, I think, one of the big questions, both at home and abroad.
Well, let's pick up on that. What you're really raising there is the perspective that follows when the town crier is asked, watchman, what of the night? What's the state of affairs? Where are we? How are we doing? And what are you? You've raised the question. Now, what's your intuition as to how we are doing?
I don't know who said it. Was it Adam Smith? There's a lot of ruin in the nation, or was it Johnson? There's a lot of ruin in the nation. That is, America has such a fundamentally powerful economy. It has fundamental liberties. It takes a lot of bureaucratic overreach, a lot of Washington overreach, a lot of mistaken tax policies and the like to crush what is a fundamentally sound economy and a constitution that fundamentally protects us. I think there are dangers, and I think we've had a slow period of growth, but I think this country is fundamentally sound.
But you seem to be worried about the effects of the last 6 years.
I'm not just worried about the effects of the last 6 years. Some of the things that I think Kitty would probably focus on, like income inequality, some of the persistent problems of race in the country and the like, are problems that far outreach the last 6 years. But I don't think the last 6 years have been a detour down the wrong path in many respects, yes.
And we'll hear from Kitty on this in a moment, but I want to check my own sense that this pretty much verifies or parallels the feelings of Chris Roebling.
Yes, I would.
But you look skeptical.
No, I think there is a question of overreach.
And I want to get back to the economy, but as a historian, I look at it in a little bit broader perspective than 5 years or 6 years or 10 years. I mean,
I've never been accused of having too narrow a perspective.
I looked at it in, you know, the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, when things were going much better, and when, you know, the lowest person in a company was making maybe 20 times less than the highest person.
Right.
And now with our economy where the lowest person in the company is making 400 times or 1,000 times less than the highest paid person, I do worry about that. You're absolutely right. I do worry about that kind of income inequality, because the only places where I've seen it in my travels have been in places like Indonesia, and I don't want the U.S. to become like Indonesia.
One way of getting into all of this is to look at some actual policy issues which have preoccupied us, correctly and appropriately preoccupy us at this moment. I remember the poem, is it Longfellow or somebody? Excelsior, he said, carrying the banner with a strange device. The banner with a strange device right now that I'm waving in the air reads Obamacare.
Right.
Is that an important part of the present picture?
Oh, it's vastly important, and I think it's an enormous rock on the body politic as we swim across the waters of time. I think that it is important to be concerned about societal cohesion, okay? But I think that societal cohesion is going to come principally from prosperity and the creation of wealth and incomes.
I agree 100%,
and
Chris.
I think that what we have in the United States in this last 13-year period, since you asked about the century, I think it is perfectly legitimate to question the direction of the nation under President Bush, which I think was a bipartisan direction. I just happened today to be looking at the Patriot Act on final passage in 2001, and the fact that it went, I think, 98-1 in the Senate, and there was one ill senator, maybe Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and she didn't vote.
Well, this was in the wake of 9/11.
This was in the wake of 9/11,
which tends to unify the country.
We had an enormous amount of support on both sides of the aisle for the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, people might say, oh, well, we agreed to one thing, but we got something else. But the fact is, there was an overextension. There was an overextension in the United States in the Middle East at that time. I think we have a mirror image overextension by Obama and what was originally the Democratic-controlled Congress, but now protected by the Democratic-controlled Senate, to increase the size in the American society that is covered by the federal government. And I think that is leading in any number of very troubling directions.
Can we get back to your question about Obamacare? Because it's
as
probably the only one in here who bought Obamacare, and I know Chris and Charles have heard about it a million.
Have you actually signed up?
Yes, I've signed up. I paid, and I didn't pay the government. I played Blue Cross.
She's
and
got
for
an
my
interesting
dental,
story.
I paid Humana. I'm a small business person. 8 years ago, I had to make the horrible choice of caring for my dying mother or giving up my insurance, which was then $2,400 a month. Which I thought was extraordinary. It was more than my mortgage. It was just my husband and myself. So we didn't have insurance for 8 years. We went to the doctor. We got medicine. We paid cash. It wasn't the ideal situation. But now that I'm able to have health care again, A, I'm paying a business, not a government. I'm paying Blue Cross and I'm paying Humana. But for dental insurance and better health insurance than we gave up, it's $450 a month, which is still a lot of money, but that's what you expect to pay. You know, that's what businesses have to pay. But it put me in a buying pool. It put me with other businesses, which is what Bob Dole tried to do, which is what Paul Tsongas tried to do, Mike Dukakis tried to do. We've been trying to have a system like this since at least 1988 that I remember, and probably you guys, Charles, remember before that. But, you know, this system is far from a socialist kind of system like Britain or Sweden, but at least it's covering more people who didn't have health care.
I think that there's a national consensus that existed before the Affordable Care Act that everybody who needed medical care should get medical care. I think that's actually a national consensus. I think that almost all the questions have to do with how to provide that, who should receive subsidies, what the nature of the provision is. If you are paying $400 a month and 10 years ago, were being charged $2,400.
No, well, yes, actually, but 2 years before that, I was paying $250 for the same policy. What happened was the insurance company dumped the group that I was in.
Yeah.
So it was just that they knew they could make money because they had us between a rock and a hard place.
There's no question that individuals and small businesses have a lot of problems with
screwed.
This.
Basic question about Obamacare, and then I want to get on to other important aspects of contemporary American life, discourse, and conflict. But basic question, do you favor or disfavor the continuation of Obamacare?
Well, I think that Obamacare is going to require vast repeal and vast revision. I agree with Charles that there isn't anybody in America who thinks that some group of Americans or some individual should go without health care. It is a question of how. I concede Kitty's point. However, I don't think that my view of the future is as sanguine because while it is a mixed, public-private program today, it is unquestionably designed this program is designed to be a transitional failure, which I think was intended by the Democrats who passed it to usher in a period of single payer like Sweden or Great Britain, a lot of European.
I so hope you're right, Chris. Yeah. But the only problem I've had with it was paying my bill. I had to call Blue Cross Blue Shield 8 times because the telephone system kept hanging up on me when I was trying to pay my bill over the phone. So other than the technology, it's working great so far.
Let me say, I think that one of the problems here is reflected in what's happened at the Veterans Affairs over the last few days. And it gets to something very fundamental that Chris was talking about. What happened in the Veterans Affairs was a very simple congressional law that was passed, and the law said if you couldn't get care within 14 days at a VA hospital, you could go to any doctor you wanted, and they would pay for you. But there wasn't enough money. So what did they do? They hid the fact that you had come in on day one so that at day 14, you couldn't go somewhere. Now, what does this tell me? It tells me that when even good-intentioned laws like this are passed, the unintended consequences, in this case, it looks like dozens of people actually dying, cannot always be forecast. We've got a big deal. It doesn't seem related, but to me it's related. The IRS. You've got bureaucracy. So what I'm talking about and what I think Chris was talking about at the very beginning is that we used to have 3 branches of government. Now we've got a 4th. These large bureaucracies, and if they're down on you, believe me, this is just beyond your scope to deal with.
And the union movement, though it is decaying in many sectors, is flourishing with regard to government employees.
Actually, it's not really flourishing. I mean,
really?
Well, it's the one place where it hasn't lost as much as in other unions, but it's still lost.
But they seem to me to have become a major political force and also a source of political
troops. But number of members and percentage of members has gone down. It's just gone down at a slower rate.
The percentage
is lower. It's gone down at a slower rate.
Watch out for overlapping voices. Let's hear from Chris.
It has gone down in some cases at a very quick rate, and that's where voluntarism has been adopted. So in Indiana, when Mitch Daniels said, and he was able to do so by executive order, that membership in public employee unions would from there on, henceforward, be voluntary. The number of the percentage of public employees in Indiana who were in the state public employee unions reduced by 91%.
Holy cow.
And in Wisconsin, when Governor Walker, through Act Number 10 a couple of years ago, made public employee union membership voluntary there, it went down by 88%. And I think this demonstrates that even we can't look at the number of people who are in those unions and imagine they are all there voluntarily.
No, the people who give home health care in Illinois were wrapped into a union. This is a court case before the Supreme Court now. These people are literally giving help to a child, their mother giving help to a child with cerebral palsy, or like you giving help to your mother or something. All of a sudden, a deal with Governor Quinn, and these people are put into a union. Well, they are trying to sue to get out of it.
Well, and in Wisconsin, they're actually, all those people have put in legislation to try to get back into the union.
Now, a change of topic. There's so much to cover and so little time. We're doing about an hour at the most. I spoke of a banner with a strange device. That's one verbal formula. Here's another recognizable verbal formulation, which leads us into a very important area. Simply the saying that demography is destiny. Look at American demography, which means presently the change in immigration in terms of who's come in and what their status is and what the one might literally say the complexion of the country is going to be as we go forward in the rest of this century. Should one care? One might note just briefly en passant that American blacks who've been here for a long time did a great deal to create and build this country are increasingly resentful. There's public opinion data to show this of the vast migration from Latin America, particularly from Mexico, and the legalization of the formerly called illegals. We no longer call them that.
I saw that in a concrete way after Katrina down in New Orleans. I have a lot of friends and I have a lot of family in New Orleans. And when that city was wiped out, it needed to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
And a lot of the rebuilding, and there was not a large Hispanic population, but they absolutely flowed in order to rebuild that city in a very effective way, even though there was a large African-American unemployed community, but not very well equipped or trained to work in that area.
And they didn't want to work for $3 an hour, which the immigrants
market rate was. But the fact is, the hard line on this was taken by Samuel Huntington. To some extent, it's been taken by Victor Davis Hanson in saying that the large influx of Mexican migrants will change the character of the country. I disagree. I think that what we confuse is the static picture with the dynamic picture. If you look at the people who are coming in, and you just average everything, what you get are new people together with people who've been here one generation, together with people who've been here three generations. What I'm seeing is that the people who've been here two generations own the businesses that are employing the people who've been here one generation. So I'm actually optimistic, and I don't see this huge cultural divide, but I do think that it is utterly within the right of the sovereign state to control who comes in, and I think that our immigration policies are broken. And one area I really want to change is I really want much more influx of highly educated, well-trained people, because I think they will help us and they'll help their own home countries.
Again, you've helped me directly. Another topic I wanted to get to, and you just said the magical word, is education.
Can we talk about immigration for just a second?
No.
Okay.
We'll come back to it later.
Because we have to, again, it's history and destiny.
Yes.
Well, all right, make your point briefly.
My favorite book in college talked about this group of bad immigrants did this, this, and this. Don't hire these people. Don't hire these people. In 1860, it was Irish.
In 1880,
it was Italian. In 1900, it was the Swedes.
Was
in
this
1920,
Oscar Hanlon?
I need to find it, but
okay.
It was the most beautiful book because it
in
showed.
In 1900, it was the Jews.
Absolutely. Every 20 years, it's
Europe.
A different group of immigrants who's being persecuted.
Yeah.
20 years, 40 years later, they're the ones whose kids are all in law school and doctors, and they're the pillars of society.
Well, don't accuse them of going to law school.
All right.
God.
You're right. But, you know, we are a society that is so strong because of our immigrant fabric, because of our mosaic. If we say no to immigrants now, we're saying no to the hardest working people in America.
Let us now go to education. Whether new entrants into the society can indeed contribute to the society and find fulfillment in this way of life depends in considerable part upon what skills they've acquired and how they use them. The skill acquisition business is essentially what education is about, not merely technical skills and how to program a computer or what have you, but rather skills in thinking, skills in sheer literacy, a way of connecting to the culture and the civilization to which the culture is a part. I, as an educator for all of my life since I got my own doctorate, have grown increasingly pessimistic and worried and depressed over the poor quality of, I would say, focusing on higher education where I've always worked, the poor quality of college education and the poor achievement levels that we now get in our graduating students. I happened to be quite convinced that one of the reasons they often do so poorly and that we create showbiz courses to interest and attract and amuse them rather than seriously program them for a better, fuller, richer life. One of the reasons is that they come so poorly prepared from the secondary schools, from the high schools, from the preparatory
and from
schools.
Elementary.
What has gone wrong, Charles Lipson? You're the educator at this table. What has gone wrong with American education, secondary and collegiate?
I think part of it has to do with the tyranny of low expectations that you were just talking about, edutainment. But I think part of it has to do also with a lot of kids coming to school unprepared. I mean, you've got So there are several different problems. One is that we have a lot of kids coming in with a single parent. The single parent can't stay at home, can't read to the child, doesn't have a very strong vocabulary, so the kid ends up coming into school ill-prepared. The second thing is we have a pretty bad K-12 education. The third thing is that you can't fire bad teachers. But I want to say a positive thing, two positive things, actually, about the system. The first is that I think there's a widespread recognition that the system is really has a lot of problems, and not just problems in the inner city, but that schools like New Trier are not as good as they
Explain
were.
Explain to the world what
New
Trier is.
And its equivalent outside of every major city is the top suburban-type school. I don't just mean New Trier. There are great schools in every suburb around every city.
Allow me a moment.
Yep.
on our website at miltrosenberg.com, there's an excerpt in the classics section where we're reproducing and replaying programs over almost 40 years of Extension 720 here at WGN, an interview with Charlton Heston, who says, among other things, he fell in love with his wife at Northwestern. He first discovered life and what the power of mind at the best high school in the country, New Trier.
You went to New Trier, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And there's a question as to whether schools like New Trier or its equivalent around Cleveland or St. Louis or even the best elite schools, public schools in Chicago.
I should make clear, New Trier is a suburban
Chicago.
It's in suburban Chicago.
Yeah.
And
in the posh suburbs.
Right, the posh suburbs. But there are very fine schools like this everywhere. And whether or not those schools are as rigorous as they were when Chris was there, the general inclination is that they are not. But I want to say two positive things. The first is that I think that there's a widespread movement to make schools competitive with each other and to let bad schools go out of business. You see that in charter schools and so forth. And, of course, the way that they will respond to that is by lobbying political leaders to keep them in business to do exactly what was done with Detroit automakers or bad solar panel makers or something, keep them in business. The second thing is, I think America is a real leader in lifelong education. Almost everybody I know is engaged in lifelong education and going to things all the time. So I wouldn't just talk about the end of education at age 21 or at age 24 when you graduate from law school. People are just going all the time.
You know what lots of personnel people at corporations will tell you about this. Yeah, we bring in young kids with their BAs or maybe with their MAs, but they really know nothing and they're not even fully literate. We take it upon ourselves to educate them beyond college because we know how to do it.
But not only that, I think there's a fascinating thing in the growth of community colleges around the country.
I have two children who've gone to community colleges.
I've been to many of them because of my travels in politics, and it's fascinating to me that, you know, while we're pricing ourselves out, well, we're pricing a lot of people out of a great college education because college has gotten so crazy expensive, but people are really taking advantage of community colleges, and I think you're right. It's not just young people. It's people at every stage of their career. It's people going back to learn a new language. It's police officers going back for continuing training.
But you can't just let them sit in class. You've got to give them
Let us now hear from
absolutely.
Let us now hear from Christopher Fitzhenry Roebling.
Thank you. I'm going to talk two things. One is about K-12 and one is about community colleges. About K-12, in the city of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, known to all of your listeners as the mayor of the city of Chicago, has an endless complaint about the city of Chicago public schools, which goes like this. He has the board of the Community College of Chicago, which is called the City Colleges of Chicago. It's a little confusing, but it's basically the community college jurisdiction. And the folks, our friends, our administrators, our instructors at the City Colleges of Chicago, for kids who come from the Chicago public schools, spend anywhere from 9 to 18 months per kid entirely on remedial learning for reading, writing, and simple arithmetic. Now, I have heard this not once, not twice. I've heard this more than half a dozen times. Wherever the mayor is, And there is a member of the board of the City Colleges of Chicago. This despair is repeated. And that, hold on one second. No. That reflects the death grip of unions on the major, hold on a second, kid, on the major city school systems of this country, and it is killing the opportunities for generations to generation. Now, here's the second thing I want to say about community colleges. Chicago is the only region in the entire country that's had the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development come from Europe to do a regional survey. They found what some of us have known for the last 15, 20 years, and that is that there is a failure of the employers on the one hand in the Chicago mm-hmm. region and the city and the community colleges on the other hand of the, to get together so that the employers who have jobs with specific skills
Absolutely.
Will get the training that is supposed to be done under our system at the community colleges so that we, for 15
Absolutely.
Years, lost more jobs to Tennessee and Alabama and Arkansas because their community colleges were more finely integrated with their employers.
I speak to my colleague from the University of Chicago, Professor Charles Lipson, who will probably be ready to disclose to you one of the great secrets of our university, where I labored for many years, and that is that many kids, possibly as many as 10 to 15%, are judged incapable of proper use of the English language after they've entered the University of Chicago, and they are assigned to go to what used to be called the Little Red Schoolhouse,
but
where they do remedial training in writing and reading. And that's the University of Chicago, one of the leading universities of the country and the world.
Actually, with fourth-year students, which is what we call seniors, I have a course called Core Western Values. It's an embarrassment to the to my colleagues who teach political theory that I have a course called Core Western Values. What an awful Eurocentric idea! And of course, these students are almost all children of immigrants who come in with a really strong desire. I asked one student once, Milt, could they name any of the predecessors of the Constitution or Declaration of Independence, anything other than Magna Carta? And it was just dead silence. And then finally, a student said, how about the Virginia Declaration of Rights? And I said, where were you educated? And he said, Singapore. So you have this, but I have them write a lot in it. One of the mm-hmm. little secrets is that writing is really hard work for the teachers because you have to correct it.
And, of course, you've heard me say many times that the cultural literacy exam that I usually gave on the last day of my largest class at the University of Chicago contains items of simple cultural literacy, one of which was, what are the dates of the American Civil War? And not one out of 20 kids could give you the right decade.
No.
You should put that on
at
your podcast. You should put that on your website. That would actually be really fascinating. Put the test up.
Permit me, another thing
it.
I had on it routinely was, some people criticized me for saying this was too specialized. Who composed the opera Tosca, and not a single one of the students was able to give you the correct answer, which is Puccini. But one kid, some said Beethoven, some said Bach, most of them just left it blank. But one kid said Tosca was composed by Toscanini.
Well, at least that was a little inventive.
Yes,
but
right.
Seriously, you should put the cultural test
the cultural
up on your website. That would be fascinating.
The decline and fall can be directly linked to the 60s adoption of the sense that we are going to have conversations with students. We're no longer going to ask them to learn dates. I mean, the idea that you can get
Thank you.
I mean, you cannot understand, Catherine and Potemkin, if you don't understand that they were at the close of the 18th century, and they
you are so right.
This is just fundamental. And now you're saying that the Civil War.
Let me add
but with writing, but with reading and writing as well. When I was in grade school, we had individualized learning. We didn't learn how to parse sentences. I didn't learn grammar until I learned French. And then I learned English grammar through learning French.
Well,
they didn't teach it in my, you know, nice suburban cushy school.
We had a diagram
sentence. And we didn't. That's the
well,
that's
I,
where it stopped. The, I was like the first this, year this, that this they is stopped topic diagramming.
Let me tell you. Let me tell you the other question I asked them after the, I've asked this. I asked them, can they tell me who was the Indian guide, Native American guide, to Lewis and Clark's expedition? And every single hand goes up.
And they say Pocahontas.
No, they do not. They say Sacagawea.
Oh, good.
And I then asked them.
They saw a movie.
And no, they were taught it in school. And I really? Asked them, how many of you think that the Indian guide who led, who helped Lewis and Clark across the West is more important to your education than the fundamental foundations of America's liberty? I want to hear which ones of you think that your textbooks were written with a real understanding of what students ought to know and what's genuinely important. Of course they're not. They're written with... they're written like Noah's Ark. Here two for the Hispanics. Here two for the Native Americans. Here's a Jew. Here's a Catholic. I mean, in other words, there's no coherence. There's no rigor. There's no decision making.
It's all agenda. This is the left.
These textbooks
are written in Texas.
We are
the largest. They are written by a very conservative company in Texas.
We're on the verge of denouncing political correctness.
That's part of the problem.
The issue is PC, which has totally penetrated our way of life. It's a key to our present culture.
But it hasn't penetrated the textbooks. I think that's where you've got a fundamental disconnect.
No.
90% of the grade school textbooks come from one company in Texas.
That's changing very rapidly because of the nature of textbook publishing. But the fact is, even in Texas, there are real problems where in the South where there are people who don't understand evolution and all the rest. So I'm not trying to dispute
let's get back to the problems in our basic education is we're not teaching facts. We're not teaching dates and times.
And this is
a problem.
It isn't all the teacher's fault. It's not that the teacher's union. The only reason I know anything is because I've got some – I happened into a few – wonderful classrooms with great teachers. That's the only reason I know a gosh darn thing.
I can testify that about Chris.
Thank you. Number two is, to get back to Charles's point of a few minutes ago, it is the families. And I would say back to your original question, Milt, if you want to know my biggest concern about American life today, in terms of outside of the official structure of organs of society, I think it's really society itself and is... is the American family understood and supported?
I could not be more pleased with what you've just said.
Thank you.
Because it's next on my agenda.
Okay.
And let me present a few simple facts known to anyone who looks at the social data. The illegitimacy rate, and I say illegitimacy meaning... meaning children born outside of wedlock.
Right.
And usually with single mothers. Because that's the way it works out. The rate has gone to some 40% for the total society. 4 out of 10 American kids born this year will be born without married parents.
And this is not just a minorities problem anymore.
Certainly not.
And in many societies...
Let me go on with this. Yeah. Let me go on with this. It's very important to look at some of the further statistics that are related thereunto. Marriage is happening later and less often.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, what we see is the decline of the family structure, which has meant a great deal to us. I will even add further, at the risk of bringing down the gods of political correctness. Does our society continue if it doesn't maintain nuclear family with some degree of cohesion, some degree of workable satisfaction, some degree of effective shaping, forming, as the Catholics say, the kids who are... of that family.
Your heads are all going to explode, so I'll just say that in the beginning. But the problem in the schools a lot is that parents haven't been parented. And how do you know how you're supposed to parent your kid if you weren't taught to bring them home and give them a good meal and make them do homework? If you never had that structure, how do you know? So we need to not only, I think, teach the kids, but to provide a lot more support for parents. Back in the day when Hull House and when we had a lot of new immigrants, we had – the schools were – called like lighthouses, where the kids would stay after school and then the parents would come in the evening and take English classes or take nutrition classes. Yeah, the schools were all open in the evenings and on the weekends, and the parents went there almost as much as
did
the kids did.
Did that happen in New York when you were growing up?
All the settlement houses.
Were there schools open in the evening to immigrant parents and so forth, Milton?
Well, they were open to my father when he came over as a very young man from what is now the Ukraine, and he learned English in school, in nighttime school, on the east side of Manhattan, where the Jewish organizations did a great deal of adult education and to shape these immigrants into effective or at least adequately
The settlement houses worked in conjunction with the schools.
Yeah.
And we in the U.S. have kind of lost that settlement house culture. But ironically, in Europe, that whole settlement house movement is still very much alive. And part of the settlement house movement there is lifetime education,
but you
were talking about.
Let me return to the how,
and I'm still – I really think we should define the what.
The what, exactly. And as regards to what, I would really raise and press the more basic question: has there been a change in our culture? Has there been a particular change in our culture so that marriage is now devalued by young people?
Not merely young people born illegitimately and in troubled families. My point was really it's not our culture; it's worldwide.
But young people who come from the middle-class world and supposedly have had opportunity for effective education. When I look at my students, and happily I don't have to look at them as much anymore since I'm now emeritus at the University of Chicago, they are, in the main, not very strongly touched by romantic aspirations and familial fantasies. In fact, the hookup culture, a part of the total picture, has given them a very different sense of what human relationships are. Essentially, they're ways of working off your sexual tensions with no commitment beyond the one night where you've hooked up with that one girl or that one boy. There's been so basic a change in all the aspects of culture that relate to the building and the maintenance of family that one really is overwhelmed by that and puzzled by what to do about it, if anything.
I want to say yes and no. And the yes part is that I think what we're having here is a bifurcation in the culture. I think that a lot – you're getting later marriage among college-educated kids and sort of white-collar kids on their way up. They're not getting married at 22 anymore. They're getting married at 32, and they're having fewer children as a result. I think a lot of the problem, and whether they get married or not, if they're living with someone in a stable relationship, as many do in Europe, that's a sort of a family in effect, if not in law. I think that the issue really has to do with what Charles Murray was talking about, with the sort of collapse of the lower middle class white families is what he focused on, but it could be said about Hispanic families.
They are the residents of what he calls Fishtown.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Now, there's a second issue, which is technology. And the fact is, about 40 years ago, for the first time in human history, you could have sex without having any worries about birth. You disentangled having sexual relations from having to pair off in a way that might potentially give you care for the lifetime of that child. To the extent that you have children in poor areas who are having baby fathers, baby mamas, you know, and no father in the picture, the father is in effect the state. The government is providing a support for them, and so these are people who are not, in effect, being held to these requirements. But I think birth control has had a very fundamental effect.
I think the recession is a huge factor in kids not getting married today. I mean,
But that's temporary.
It's temporary, but it's been, you know, 5 years, which is not really, or 8 years, which is not really temporary.
Well, that's because we elected your guy president.
It started with your guy Bush. But the point I was trying to make was it's a problem, or it's a situation, but not just here in the United States. I think it's globally.
In Italy, for example, they live with their parents
Ireland,
until they're 26.
In Ireland, in Spain, in Sweden, you know, there's people are just getting married a lot less.
Well, what we
is it a historical cycle?
We'll talk about history. You read the Old Testament. For every 50 pages that the Israelites are partying and wandering off from God, there's only 10 pages where they're back on the program. And then you get to page 69 or 70, and they're veering off again. They're gone for another 40 pages.
We are next people.
And I'm going to say that there certainly are some. But if you understand, Charles is talking about the origin of American liberty, and the idea that the context within which, okay, the picture frame within which that was to take place was one in which there were many assumptions. Now, people today would say, oh, many of those assumptions were wrong or bad or ignorant or passé or politically incorrect or something like that.
Yeah.
But so let's take just by agreement for the sake of conversation. We'll take
but
all those out.
At the time that they started.
Well, we'll just take those out. We'll say, all right, well, what were the assumptions that the assumptions were that people are committed to each other, that there is love in a family, that love kind of begins to form these children, and that family then works as a mediation between the individual and the greater society. And so you get people who are well formed, and they've inculcated a respect for some sort of code of behavior. Okay, today, and I am not a hidebound, you know, backward looking, no fun kind of guy, but I think we can say, in answer to your question, Milt, at least with respect to the United States, I don't deny that there are issues everywhere, but as you have seen, the questioning of societal norms that truly gained, you know, began maybe with a beat culture, but then became a broadly understood and discussed societal phenomenon in the 60s and the 70s. I think what that has led to is with a government that was not exactly, according to Moynihan 45 years ago, doing everything it could to keep families together. In fact, it was kind of acting in the opposite direction. I think all of these things have contributed.
Kind of begets divorce, too.
One basic point here, which is the fundamental social building block of this country and any other civilization is a family. And the fact is there are a lot of pressures to wedge and break apart families in our society, and one of the central elements of social policy that could really help at the level of education, at the level of training of children, at the level of just so many things, is to try to figure out how to reverse what has been a declining trend.
And when people want to get married and raise children, we should support them.
Oh, I agree with that. See, I'm on the other side on the gay marriage
issue. Yeah, because my friends who are adopting kids who wouldn't otherwise have parents are mostly gay and forming relationships and forming families.
As long as they don't require me to get married to a gay person.
No, they don't require you to get married to anybody.
Oh, good.
No.
Then I'm for it.
No,
okay.
And you don't even have to like them.
Oh, I do like them, but just not in that way.
I'm not necessarily opposed to gay marriage. I mentioned it because there was a real concern on the part of some people. And it does seem to me what influence it has had or what effect it has had upon how people shape their own notions of marriage is a necessary and a legitimate question. Also, there are in many law schools law professors who are arguing that the next logical and required step, and it's a step that will be taken and should be taken and should be defended, is polyamory, as they sometimes call it, or at least some introduction.
This is the reason the word oi was invented.
Now, having said make a really wacky argument about the lack of – no, I'm just – this is theoretical only, that, you know, in the black community, there's a huge problem because there aren't enough black men for the number of black women. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Listen, I want to go someplace else now. We've got about 10 minutes left, and you are all political activists. And we haven't talked about politics present and politics
to come. Isn't
that
great?
Let us go directly to the simple question of what happens in 2016. What about the next presidential election? And I would raise the skeptical or cynical question of, and does it make any difference?
Well, I posted today on my Facebook page, to which I welcome any listener.
Which now has a Blackhawks thing on it instead of your face.
I put the Blackhawks thing up whenever they're in the playoffs. But I got to say, I saw something today. Kitty, please forgive me in advance. But
it's okay.
I saw something on YouTube today. A reporter at a meeting of the Democratic National Committee started interviewing attendees at this meeting. And he said, look, I want to talk to you about Hillary. And each one of them, I want to talk about Hillary. What is she? Why is she so special? Well, you know, and they all started to talk about she was in the White House for 8 years and she's Secretary of State for 8 years. She was in the Senate. Well, that's great. Now, what did she do? I'm not kidding. 4.5 minutes of video. Not one of these interviewees at the Democratic National Committee meeting could name one policy accomplishment of Hillary Clinton.
Hillary herself couldn't.
So she's basically turning into
what her accomplishment as Secretary of State was, and she basically said, I'll get back to you.
And George Will incorrectly recalled the Roger Mudd Teddy Kennedy interview and said that it was 1980, whereas those of us who remember were sitting by the TV set, no, it was October of 1979. And the fact that Teddy bombed in October of 1979 made life that much easier for President Carter.
Do you remember what that was? Dwight Eisenhower's response to Richard Nixon. He was asked.
I'll get back to you.
He was asked, what was Richard Nixon's accomplishment as vice president? He said, I'll get back to you.
But I'm saying,
I agree, Chris. The first thing that anybody should, who wants to run for office, the first thing that they should be able to say, and when people come into our office, it's what we say, you have to tell us, why are you running?
Right.
And why should we vote for you? What have you done?
And so in answer to your question, Milton, you asked about 16. We've got 14 between now and 16, but I'm answering your question. I think if the Republicans somehow avoid doing to themselves, shooting, you know, all of their toes, all of their fingers, all of their feet and ankles off, it's going to be a romp. I think it is going to be a romp because, with all respect to Kitty and her friends, her personal friends who are physically running the country right now, they've done a terrible job. It's not because of Kitty, but they've done a horrible job, and people are going to be crying for a change.
I think what they've done a really horrible job about is reminding about the accomplishments. I completely agree with you on that. And I think the one thing that I guarantee in November is November of 2014, I guarantee that when I wake up the next morning, Chris and I will feel exactly the same about one thing.
What?
Not enough people voted.
Well, let me say.
And that's all part of the civic education that we were talking about earlier and the breakdown of the family. People aren't taught about government. They're not taught that it's a right and a responsibility to vote.
I think that one of the disturbing features of our politics has been since, at least since 2008, every election has been a throw-the-bums-out election. The genius of Axelrod in packaging Barack Obama in 2008 was to package throw-the-bums-out as hope and change. Mm-hmm. A vacuous phrase, but he made it positive. He gave us positive spin. If I think what the Republicans should run on is on the economy and the overreach of Washington and its bureaucracy. And the success...
Oh, are you talking 16 or 14?
I'm talking about both, actually, but certainly in 14.
Okay.
They're going to be running on Obamacare, of course, but and the scandals, so the sort of incompetence of the current administration. But I think if the Republicans stress social issues, they will really alienate many of the swing voters, and they've done it before. They just can't help themselves. They want to go out there and tell Kitty who who she should date and who she
and
should marry.
And what I should do while I'm on the date.
Exactly. And that, I think both parties have a bossy wing. One wing wants to tell you exactly what to drive, exactly what to drink, and that's bad enough. But to tell you who to marry and what you should do on a date, no.
And what you shouldn't do.
No. So I think that the Republicans are in great position. And the other thing we hadn't talked about, Milt, is where is this country growing? 30% of the jobs have been in Texas. Why is that? Well, part of it has to do with energy economy, but that's not the main reason. The main reason is that things that take 18 months to get a permit in Chicago, you can get in an afternoon in Texas. These are states that just want to make things happen, and this state doesn't.
Well, I should say that because you have a global audience, I mean, we don't want to get too wrapped up into Illinois, but it is true that if you go through and you look at the right-to-work states, the states in which all union membership is voluntary, they have higher growth rates, they have higher job creation rates, they have higher rates of net inbound investment.
And their wages are higher. The new job.
Exactly. The wages are higher.
That's not true.
It is
that's
true.
That's not true.
Kitty?
The wages in Texas are...
Newly created jobs in Texas are at higher than the national
wage. That's exactly right.
But
the overall jobs in Texas are at
true,
a deplorably
newly
low
created
rate.
Jobs, which is where Texas is creating 30%.
I want to say something to Kitty. Yeah.
There are more minimum wage jobs in Texas than any other jobs.
I think that understanding the distribution of jobs over an economy and a population, one has to look at the population and its skill set as one is looking at the jobs. And even if there are more minimum wage jobs, for the sake of conversation, I'll accept what you're saying. I'm going to suggest that there are probably more $100,000 a year jobs in Texas than there are in other states that are, on a proportional basis. And the reason that I'm saying this is the existence of a minimum wage job in and of itself is not a societal bad. That is not a societal wrong. And I am a guy who believes that there are different jobs for different people at different stages in their lives, and that's an okay thing. What we need in this country, and what I mean the fundamental thing you need in any economy is formation of investment capital so that there can be more job creation.
We have only a few minutes. A last thought. Is it not possibly the case that all of our ruminations tonight are really essentially irrelevant because we face a great coming disaster, the disaster of the environment collapsing under us or becoming so contaminated that life as we know it essentially will not be plausible or possible? The current president of the United States has issued that warning. A colleague of his, a former vice president of the United States, is virtually the father of environmental anxiety. And we are told that lots of people, particularly conservatives, like one has to say, Chris Roebling, don't take that seriously enough. That's really what we should have been talking about during all of the last 45 minutes. Is that true?
It's a fear that I have that I shared with Barry Goldwater, who understood it very much, and Richard Nixon, which is why he created the Environmental Protection Agency. It's conservative to the core. We need to conserve what we've been given. A lot of the churches around the country have really moved into environmental protection in a big way, and I think that if all of us, China is very nice to go and visit the new bustling million people towns, but you can't breathe while you're there. We don't want to be like that.
I talked with a senior Chinese official at lunch, very, very senior official at a small lunch this week. And basically what I was asking him is whether he thought that building cheap power plants that would smoke up the environment but keep growth relatively high was a better thing for China than the people in the cities who now had rising wealth and wanted to have a cleaner environment, which was the greater political risk. And what I thought I heard from him was that he saw that shifting now. They, I think, in China now face a real Hobson's choice, because they really don't believe that they can allow growth to slip under 7%, which is an unrealistic target over the long run. The United States has never grown on a consistent basis more than about 3% over the long run. But people in cities do not like living like this, and they are beginning to push back. So you're right.
But is anthropogenic global warming likely to invalidate the very functionality of the planet itself?
No, it's not. It doesn't exist as it has been described. The climate has been changing, you know, for the last 4 or 5 billion years on this planet, and especially the last 250 million years. And the truth is that most of the popularly understood expressions that are related to either the term global warming or the movement itself had to abandon that term when there was no global warming. So now they call it climate change. And now that change, that has become a problem. So they're calling it now climate disruption. What we are talking about here are models, not data. Models are not data. Data is data. And we are really better advised to focus on other issues.
And with that, friends, I must say, quoting Will Shakespeare, our revels now are ended. And I thank you most sincerely. It's been great fun and very illuminating. My thanks to Chris Roebling, to Kitty Kurth, and to Charles Lipson.